prescribed method. Hmm.
Vividahai. With varieties. Dravyahai. Paraphernalia. Desha. According to country. Kala. Time. Vibhagavit. One who knows the divisions. Translation, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. This is the 12-syllable mantra for worshipping Lord Krishna. One should install the physical forms of the Lord, and with the chanting of the mantra, one should offer flowers and fruits and other varieties of foodstuffs exactly according to the rules and regulations prescribed by authorities. But this should be done in consideration of place, time, and attendant conveniences and inconveniences. The purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya is known as the Dvadashakara Mantra. This mantra is chanted by Vaishnav devotees and it begins with Pranava or Omkara. There is an injunction that those who are not Brahmanas cannot pronounce the Pranava Mantra. But Dhruva Maharaj was born a Kshatriya. He had once admitted before Narada Muni that as a Kshatriya he was unable to accept Narada's instruction of renunciation and mental equilibrium, which are the concern of a Brahmana. Still, although not a Brahmana, but a Kshatriya, Dhruva was allowed, on the authority of Narada, to pronounce the Pranava Omkara. This is very significant. Especially in India, the caste Brahmanas object greatly when persons from other castes who are not born in Brahman families recite this Pranava mantra. But here is tacit proof that if a person accepts the Vaishnav mantra or Vaishnav way of worshipping the deity, he is allowed to chant the Pranava mantra. In Bhagavad Gita, the Lord personally accepts that anyone, even one of a low species, can be elevated to the highest position and go back home, back to Godhead, simply if he worships properly. The prescribed rules, as stated here by Narada Muni, are that one should accept the mantra through a bona fide spiritual master and hear the mantra in the right ear. Not only should one chant or murmur the mantra, but in front of him he must have the deity or physical form of the Lord. Of course, when the Lord appears, it is no longer a physical form. For example, when an iron rod is made red hot in a fire, it is no longer iron, it is fire. Similarly, when we make a form of the Lord, whether of wood or stone or metal or jewels or paint, or even a form within the mind, it is a bona fide spiritual transcendental form of the Lord. Not only must one receive this mantra from the bona fide spiritual master like Narada Muni or his representative in the disciplic succession, but one must chant the mantra. And not only must one chant, but he should also offer whatever foodstuff is available in his part of the world according to time and convenience. The method of worship, chanting the mantra and preparing the forms of the Lord, is not stereotyped, nor is it exactly the same everywhere. It is specifically mentioned in this verse that one should take consideration of the time, place, and available conveniences. Our Krishna consciousness movement is going on throughout the entire world, and we also install deities in different centers. Sometimes our Indian friends, puffed up with concocted notions, criticize, "This has not been done. That has not been done." But they forget this instruction of Narada Muni to one of the greatest Vaishnavas, Dhruva Maharaj. One has to consider the particular time, country, and conveniences. What is convenient in India may not be convenient in the Western countries. Those who are not actually in the line of acharyas or personally have no knowledge of how to act in the role of acharya unnecessarily criticize the activities of the ISKCON movement in countries outside of India. The fact is that such critics cannot do anything personally to spread Krishna consciousness. If someone goes and preaches, taking all risks, allowing all considerations for time and place, it might be that there are changes in the manner of worship, but that is not at all faulty according to Shastra. Srimad Bhairagava Acharya, an acharya in the disciplic succession of the Ramanuja Sampradaya, has remarked in his commentary that chandalas or conditioned souls who are born in lower than Shudra families can also be initiated according to circumstances. The formalities may be slightly changed here and there to make them Vaishnavas. Lord Chaitanya recommends that his name should be heard in every nook and corner of the world. How is this possible unless one preaches everywhere? The cult of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Bhagavata Dharma, and he especially recommends Krishna Katha, or the cult of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. He recommends that every Indian considering this task to be para upakara, or welfare activity, take the Lord's message to the other residents of the world. Other residents of the world does not refer only to those who are exactly like the Indian Brahmins and Kshatriyas, or like the caste Brahmanas, who claim to be Brahmanas because they were born in the family of Brahmanas. The principle that only Indians and Hindus should be brought into the Vaishnav cult is a mistaken idea. There should be propaganda to bring everyone to the Vaishnav cult. The Krishna consciousness movement is meant for this purpose. There is no bar to propagating the Krishna consciousness movement even among people who are born in Chandala, Mlecha, or Yavana families. Even in India, this point has been enunciated by Sanatana Goswami in his book Hari Bhakti Vilas, which is Smriti and is the authorized Vedic guide for Vaishnavas in their daily behavior. Sanatana Goswami says that as bell metal can turn to gold when mixed with mercury in a chemical process, so by the bona fide diksha, or initiation method, anyone can become a Vaishnava. One should take initiation from a bona fide spiritual master coming in the disciplic succession who is authorized by his predecessor spiritual master. This is called diksha vidana. Lord Krishna states in the Bhagavad Gita, Vyapashvacha, one should accept a spiritual master. By this process, the entire world can be converted to Krishna consciousness. So the verse again, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, Mantre Na Nena Devasya Kurya Dravya Mayam Buddha. So Paryam Vividar Dravyar Desha Kala Vibhagavit. So Om Maganat Chivananda Shah Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So this verse is very interesting, and it indicates in a very interesting way. It indicates in a very interesting way that the Brahmanas in India generally develop this exclusivity mentality. That means that because they are Brahmanas, they develop what's called a monopoly. You know what a monopoly is? Monopoly means, I think, basically they think they're the only ones who can do not only the chanting of the mantra, but they're the only ones who can do the different samskaras or perform funeral ceremonies or anything like that. And therefore, people become dependent on these personalities, and therefore they're able to make money at doing this, which is actually contrary to the position of a Brahmana. A real Brahmana is renounced, and he lives simply. He takes voluntary austerity, he eats very simply, etc., like that. So he's not really dependent upon financial means. He's actually dependent on Krishna. That's what a Brahmin means. And the Brahmin's livelihood is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Yajan Yajan, Patan Patan Dana Pratigraha, which means he can do sacrifice, he can teach about sacrifice, he can accept charity, he can give charity, he can teach knowledge, and he can hear knowledge. These are the Brahmin's activities. So, unfortunately, when we put power in the hands of a particular class of people, not just Brahmanas, but any particular class, even, Kshatriyas, without checks and balances, what happens is that they start to exploit. As they say, power corrupts. In other words, absolute power corrupts. Absolutely, we know about that statement. So the Brahmanas, traditionally in India, let's go back about 2,500 years. The Brahmanas had actually taken practically complete control of society for pecuniary, which means financial reasons. And the Kshatriyas were actually upset at this, which is really interesting. This is actually modern history. This is not like ancient history. This is modern. Actually, it's recorded history. It's about 2,500 years ago. The Brahmanas actually became corrupt. And of course, they were corrupt many times before that. And of course, in the Bhagavatam, it says in Kali Yuga, sometimes the demons will take birth in Brahmin families. It actually says that in the predictions, one of the predictions of Kali Yuga. So the Brahmanas actually became very corrupt. They were engaged not only in exploiting people, in claiming exclusivity, that they were the only ones who could perform these sacrifices, and you have to pay them a certain amount of money to do the sacrifice, just like you'll sometimes see in temples, they'll actually make a list that says, you know, if you want a baby puja done, it's going to cost you $50. You ever seen that list? Mm-hmm. Pretty wild. Actually, the Brahmana should not have a price list like a restaurant. Isn't it? But you've seen it, isn't it? If you want to have Nam Karnana, you know, your name of your kid given, then it will cost you $100. If you want to die, it'll cost you, you know, $300. If you want a wedding, that's, you know, $10,000. Depending on how much money you have, you know, there's a sliding scale. We will negotiate with you. So, anyway, so the Brahmanas not only were doing that, exploiting people in that way, but also they were exploiting poor innocent animals. They were killing animals without any cause. In the previous yuga, there were actually gomeda and ashwamedha sacrifices performed, where the animal was offered in sacrifice and rejuvenated in that sacrifice. But in the Kali Yuga, that's prohibited. Gomeda and ashwamedha are prohibited. Actually, even in other religions, you have evidence of some sort of animal sacrifice. In the Old Testament, for example, you have animals being sacrificed. In fact, at one point, there was someone who was asked to sacrifice his own son. That was Abraham. You know, that was pretty heavy. Anyway, so he didn't do it. God stopped him just when he was getting ready to chop the guy's head off. So the Brahmins were engaged in animal slaughter, basically, in the name of sacrifice, and eating the meat afterwards in the name of sacrifice, and exploiting people in the name of brahminical activities. So that was 2,500 years ago. So as a result of that, there was a rebellion in society. And it's very interesting what that rebellion consisted of. It was many types of, manifestations in that rebellion. There were internal Vedic rebellions, and there were external rebellions outside of the Vedic system. The internal rebellion was basically people headed for the forest. And you understand, they actually left the cities because the Brahmanas were more or less like controlling everything. They just like, you know, they were called the Aranyakas. Aranya means basically the forest. The forest, like you have, anyway, Aranya tena gantavyam yata aranyam yatagraham. This is a statement by Chanaka Pandit who says, like, if you're living at home and your wife doesn't speak pleasingly, you should head for the forest. We don't want to give that instruction to anybody. Nobody's here to hear. Nobody listens. So anyway. So Aranyaka. So these people headed for the forest, and they were more interested in spiritual knowledge than in just these rituals. The Brahmanas, they were just like really into the rituals. Like you see nowadays, you know, people, even sometimes our Brahmanas in ISKCON, they really get into like what spoon to use when you're putting the ghee on the fire, and you know what part of the body to touch and everything like that. It's really interesting. I mean, I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying people really get into it. Really get into it. And so what happened is that they had an internal rebellion. People went to the forest, and then they didn't criticize those Brahmanas so much, but they actually started to cultivate knowledge, and eventually they actually composed many of the Upanishads. You understand? The Upanishadic literature. And the Upanishadic literature was meant for spiritual upliftment. Although sacrifices are mentioned in the Upanishadic literature, the main focus or the main point was spiritual upliftment and, you know, philosophy. And the word Upanishad actually means that if you want to have knowledge, you sit down at the feet of the spiritual master. That's what it means. come closer and sit down, basically. So that was one group that revolted against the Brahmanas. Another group that revolted against the Brahmanas was the Buddhists. In 400 BC, you had Siddhartha, who was a Kshatriya. It's interesting because you had a Kshatriya rebellion against the Brahmanas. Siddhartha Gautama, the famous Buddha, he actually, after he got enlightened, you know, he left his kingdom because he discovered there was birth, death, disease, and old age, and his parents were trying to shield him from that. And then he led a whole revolt against the Brahmanas too, specifically because of the Brahmanas, as Prabhupada mentions elsewhere, were engaged in animal slaughter in the name of religion. So his topmost dharma was ahimsa, which means nonviolence. Ahimsa paramo dharma. So he led a rebellion against the Brahmanas. And then also there was another person called Mahavir, a Jain. And he led a rebellion against the Brahmanas. And the Jains are very much into nonviolence too. You know, they put a mask on their faces so they don't breathe any microbes or, yeah. And actually they have many things. They don't eat anything that grows in the ground, carrots or potatoes or anything like that. And they're very, very careful about it. Somehow or other, it's hurting it more, killing the thing. See, when you pick a fruit from the tree, it doesn't kill the tree. But when you actually take the carrot from the ground, you kill the poor little carrot. Anyway, we offer to Krishna, so we don't worry about it. But if we didn't offer to Krishna, we'd be responsible for killing the carrot. So the Jains, they do all sorts of things like that. And they're actually quite nice people. Very austere, quite nice people. And they, you know, I've dealt with them. They like Krishna consciousness. And of course, they're very rich, too. But there's only about 6,000 of them. 6 million, sorry. 6 million of them in India today. They're pretty much very small. And the Buddhists are practically non-existent in India, but they're all over the world right now. The Buddhists you'll find in Thailand. You'll find the Buddhists in Nepal. So many Buddhists in Nepal. The Buddhists in Sri Lanka. So all along the periphery of India, you'll find the Buddhists. In fact, you know, in Afghanistan, you had these giant Buddhist statues that the Taliban destroyed. Maybe you've heard about that. They were actually giant statues. I mean, they were probably maybe 200 feet high or something like that. I don't know the exact dimensions. But the Taliban just blasted them because what happens with, you know, fanatical members of the Muslim religion is they're against any sort of form. It's interesting. They're against any sort of form of God, but material forms they worship. I mean, they're, anyway, like their wife's form they're interested in. But it's interesting. I mean, if you get into it, you know, what can I say? And not to criticize anyone. But, you know, God can't have a form, but, you know, we love all the other forms that are coming out. So, so even Mahavir, the Jain, he was actually a Kshatriya from Kshatriya family. So it was like a Kshatriya rebellion against the Brahmanas who were exploiting people and exploiting animals. And so you'll see this sort of dynamic occurring many times in the history of India. And actually, not only in the history of India, in the Middle East too, you'll find, like, the Jewish people, for example, there was the priestly caste before Jesus Christ appeared. You know, Jesus Christ's pastimes were more or less rebellion against the Jewish Brahmanas. You know, they weren't Brahmanas, I understand. But they were the Sanhedrin, or the priests. And in Judaism, because I know a little bit about this, they have different tribes. And certain tribes are actually considered the priestly tribes. Not the tribe I was born in, but anyway, too bad. But it's like that's hereditary casting in Judaism. At least it was. Not so much anymore. So you have these rebellions. It's interesting, you have rebellions against different things. And then, as a result of the rebellions, the group that's being rebelled against sort of reforms itself for some time. So the Brahmanas, which is very interesting, look at the history of India, the Brahmanas who were actually losing their power due to this rebellion, or the rebellions, reformed themselves and actually became, let's say, better at marketing themselves to the people. It's all marketing. Like, religion is all marketing, actually, how you package the product. So they became better at marketing. And so what they did is, you know, instead of being so much into rituals, they actually concentrated more on worshiping particular personalities, and especially they got more into a theological understanding, which is, you know, worshiping God. And that attracted people back from Buddhism and Jainism back to Hindu culture. And of course, Shankaracharya was particularly responsible for that. What he did is he packaged Hinduism, or, you know, what we're calling Hinduism. Of course, there's no such thing as Hinduism. But he packaged the presentation of the Vedic tradition in such a way that you had practically the same philosophy as Buddhism, but you added, you know, worship of different entities. So the problem with Buddhism, at least the original Buddhism, there was no concept of any person, you know, any supreme god, or even any demigods. So you're sort of left with just a really dry philosophical heritage there. That's called Theravada Buddhism, the original Buddhism. And that's what Buddha taught. Buddha did not teach what people are doing in the name of Buddhism today. You know, if you go into a Buddhist temple now, they'll have all these, like, bodhisattvas there. I don't know if you've ever been to a Buddhist temple. I've seen it from the outside. They'll have all these bodhisattvas there. They'll talk about, you know, the different levels of heaven. Buddha never mentioned anything like that. Buddha's presentation was more or less a philosophical, psychological presentation. So, but let me get further into the history. So anyway, so we'll get back to Buddhism in a second. So the Brahmanas, they actually brought more of the theological aspects of the worship of persons, but still maintaining the Buddhist philosophy, which is, you know, ultimately, when you get liberated, you either, you know, merge into everything or you're nothing, which is actually very similar. So people became attracted back to the Hindu fold or the Vedic fold, and they basically left Buddhism and left Jainism. Like I said, there's 6 million Jains in India. That's nothing. And it's practically no Buddhists. So that's part of the history. Then, it even gets more interesting, because then the Buddhists responded to the market at that point, and they came up, because they saw that people wanted person, you know, to worship personal gods, or, you know, they wanted, there was a bhakti, you know, people wanted to have some love for someone. Even if they were doing karma kanja stuff, or worshiping like demigods for something ulterior, you know, ulterior motives, they actually wanted to have some personal relationships, because people weren't satisfied with the original Theravada Buddhism, where, of course, Buddha taught basically, you know, the material world is suffering. Suffering is caused by greed, and, you know, if you get rid of the greed, then you get rid of the suffering. And this, the Eightfold Noble Path, is the way of getting rid of the suffering. You know, right thinking, you know, right actions, and things like that. That's what Buddha taught. Basically, it was a simple thing like that. If you read his sermons, that's basically what he's teaching. So, but Buddhism had to reinvent itself too, to try to get people back, and that's where you get the Mahayana Buddhism, which is the Mahayana Buddhism is actually where you get all these bodhisattvas and the different levels of heaven, and, you know, people come back, you know, to save others. So that was actually an imitation of what the Hindus were presenting. So you actually see that religion sort of, or the presentation of religion, reinvents itself due to market forces, which is really interesting, isn't it? It's quite interesting. So anyway, so that's pretty much in relation to what Prabhupada is saying. Like, the ritualistic Brahmanas may criticize us for what we're doing, but they're not making any devotees. You know, they may criticize us. Then, it's very interesting, we got criticized by, at least Prabhupada got criticized by many of his god brothers, for doing what he's doing. Then when they saw he was successful, they started to imitate him. Isn't it? And now they're in the West, and now we have so many Gaudiya groups that are being led by different Gaudiya mats. they're imitating Prabhupada. So you see how the market or the market forces influence the whole presentation of religion. And they reform religion. They're actually a force that reforms religion. It's very interesting. It's very interesting. Even in Prabhupada's interactions with his godbrothers or with those who would criticize him. So many people criticize Prabhupada, not only in the Gaudi Math, for coming to the West and making the lectures devotees and everything like that, but even outside in other Hindu traditions. And now you have people from all sorts of Hindu traditions coming to the West to make followers, isn't it? Like you even have ladies who come and hug people to make followers, right? Hama, yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, Prabhupada was basically the first. Of course, you had other smaller people, Guru Maharaj, Maharishi, Mahesh Yogi, but as far as really like getting people committed, Prabhupada was the first. And then you find people imitate afterwards. They change their presentation in order to be competitive. So if you understand marketing, you can actually see how people, you can understand religion to a larger extent. Think about it. Isn't that interesting? It's interesting how, you know, and also ISKCON is doing that too, right now, because like in the 1960s when we were preaching, you know, all we had to do was go out and say, here's some prasadam, you know, come follow us. But nowadays, we have other people who are doing kirtans, sweet kirtans and things like that, you know, like have Jayutal, Krishnadas and other people like that. So the devotees are starting to change their approach to meet the competition. And you have other people who are teaching yoga. You know, if you taught during the 1960s and 70s in our movement, if you talk to devotees about hatha yoga, they tell you you're in big maya. Isn't that true? If you said, you know, let's have like a hatha yoga class to bring people to Krishna consciousness, they say, you know, Prabhupada says, you know, it's a waste of time, you rascal, you demon, or something like that. But now, we got all these devotees setting up yoga centers, you know, loft preaching, yoga centers and everything like that. So in response to the market forces. So even you see that nowadays with ISKCON. Think about it. I mean, it's actually quite interesting how it's like a dialectic, like Hegel's dialectic, which probably you don't know what I'm talking about, where you have thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Like you do something and then someone opposes you, you know, the antithesis, and then you actually adjust yourself, or both sides adjust themselves. So, anyway, that's religion. It's religion because religion basically means marketing, unless you happen to be a religion that kills people if you don't join. That's a sort of marketing, you know. We're offering something in our religion that you can live if you join our religion. Isn't that, that's a pretty good way to market your religion. You have a choice, you know, you join us or die. So I guess you could call that marketing, a marketing technique, but it's not one that we want to employ. But you actually see, you know, religion is like business. So what do we learn by this? We learn that when we're presenting Krishna consciousness, we have to, yeah, you have to go. Okay, have a good time. Thanks for coming. Give him some prasad.
I've got some already.
Okay. Anyway, so let's end here. So any questions or comments?
Yes.
Yes. Haribol.
I got a question to
him. Yeah.
Narayan Rishi, we call that. Now, followers of Narayan Rishi. They're just changed slightly. They're, you know, they're not following the principles of the regulations which was made by
they're marketing.
Marketing, this is what
they're marketing. They,
even here in Fiji you can see that, you know, like keeping beer and that sort of thing, you know, and slightly they're changing the ways, but
well, they're trying to market, that's the whole
thing. But coming different way, are they reaching Krishna consciousness in a different way?
To a certain extent, yes. I mean, just like if they adjust the amount of rounds required for initiation, you know, to a certain extent, they're using intelligent marketing skills. I'm not saying Yeah, I can't make a comment. I'm not going to make a comment on their level of spirituality or anything like that. All I'm saying is that they're looking at the market, and they're saying, basically, they're saying, you know, asking people to chant 16 rounds is pretty heavy. And so, you know, 4 rounds is more practical. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying it's wrong. All I'm saying is it's their marketing. Isn't it? I mean, I've thought, you know, I thought for some time we should have a level of initiation where people can just chant 4 rounds. You know, and but we're constrained by what Prabhupada did. So perhaps in the future we'll have a different we'll add levels of commitment. You know, so we can actually still follow exactly what Prabhupada did, but, you know, add some things that are levels of commitment. You understand? Like, now we just have, like, basically 2 levels of commitment, which are first initiation, second initiation, and of course you have the sannyas. But so we can always add things like Prabhupada added life membership or something like that. So we can say that, you know, there's a pre-initiation or a level of commitment when you're chanting 4 rounds and following the regulative principles, and, you know, even give them a spiritual name at that point. I mean, there's perhaps adjustments we could make to deal with the competition. Yeah, because when you're competing in the marketplace, you've got to make adjustments. You got to repackage your product. I mean, just like anything sold in the supermarket, you know. They repackage their product, they relabel the product, they brand it, and everything like that. So we have to be very alert, or else we're going to be left in the dust. What's that?
There's a person there in Lisbon.
Yeah.
He comes to the temple, he mixes it with us, but slightly his voice by his group is slightly different, you know. He's got his own scriptures and that sort of thing, you know.
His own scriptures.
Yeah. And
well, as long as he doesn't preach to us, I mean, we're open to everybody.
He comes to the temple,
yeah,
right there, but slightly different way he prays, you know. I was a bit surprised at this.
Well, we have to allow people to do that, but as long as he doesn't preach to us and tell us to join in.
What I'm trying to say is that his Guru Maharaj is also a disciple of Prabhupada. I don't know why he attend, you know, slightly against Prabhupada's instructions.
What does he do against Prabhupada's instructions?
Well, actually, the prayers slightly different. It's twisting around, you know.
What prayers?
Even Guru has called him something else.